Okay, so thanks to the organizers for arranging this pretty amazing conference. It's really a kind of a convergence of many different types of theoretical physics. I'm not sure I would have guessed such a conference would have occurred, let's say, 5 years back. And I've been asked to give an overview about entanglement in condensed matter. Okay, so that's a slightly broad topic. So here's my plan, how I want to go about doing this. So it's kind of like an RG approach. I'll start with sort of a very broad introduction, talk about what are the overarching themes and questions that we have in mind in condensed matter physics. And luckily for me, there are a number of other overviews also on topics that I'm going to be touching on. So I'll kind of tell you how these fit into this sort of broader theme and sort of point you to the topics, to the talks where these will be overviewed in more detail. And then finally, I'll just to make this sort of specific, I'll try to give you a feeling for how, at least in one particular case, we've managed to use entanglement really as a tool to understand some new physics. Okay, and it'll really be a very simple setting, free fermion band structures, and hopefully I'll have time at the end to announce a new result that we used some of these methods to establish a kind of band insulator that was sort of previously unexpected. Okay, so so really for this talk, and for much of the applications of entanglement to condensed matter physics, we'll really focus on qualitative properties of a many-body system. Okay, so we won't really be interested in calculating very detailed quantitative properties. We'll really want to understand what are the essential defining features of a quantum many-body system. And of course, many-body, at least from the formal point of view, is thinking of a system with many degrees of freedom, essentially infinite number of degrees of freedom. Okay, and one of the key questions comes up is, when you have many degrees of freedom, you can get different phases of matter, and how do we classify these different states of matter? Okay, and one operational definition is that you have different states or different phases if they're always separated by phase transition, okay, where something singular happens. Okay, but we'd like to sort of go beyond this and to take a point of view that's from outside of physics. Let me give you an analogy to what this project is really about. Okay, so there is this puzzle. Many of you may have heard about it. I'm pretty sure none of you have played this puzzle. It's from a previous generation, I think. It involves, I guess there are some people from previous generation, sorry. Okay, so so the idea is the following. So you have all of these numbers, and the idea is to make moves, which is just moving these tiles around and trying to get to this particular configuration. Okay, and this configuration just has the last two numbers interchanged. And the question is, can you go from from this configuration to that by just making these moves, or is it impossible? Okay, so of course, if they can be connected, you can do that. You can sort of demonstrate a set of moves. But what if they are not? If you cannot make this connection, okay. So you should think of these as two different phases, maybe potentially, and you're trying to go smoothly from one to the other. If you succeed, you know they are in the same phase. But if you fail, you don't know if you have just missed something that you could have tried, or whether it's fundamentally impossible. Okay, so in this particular case, turns out this thing is it is impossible to go from one to another. And the way you can prove that is you can construct a conserved quantity which is different for these two states. Okay, so there's a conserved quantity which is unaffected by these moves. Essentially, it's the parity of this permutation. And if you keep this blank square in the same row, and these two configurations differ in their parity. Okay, so when you can construct such a quantity, you're sort of proved that it's impossible to connect these things. Okay, of course, you could imagine breaking this apart and reassembling it. That's the phase transition. Okay, so if you have to do something singular to get from here to there, that's there are different phases. Okay, so it turns out that for conventional phases, we know how to do this. but the question is really how to do this for for more generally. Okay, so let me remind you how this works for conventional phases. In the context of, for example, a solid to liquid, you're trying to make a distinction between a solid and a liquid. A solid breaks symmetry, and this is typical of conventional phases, and there's a way to quantify this symmetry breaking using an order parameter. And once you do that, you're really in very good shape. Okay, all of the interesting questions that you might ask about solids, you can, in principle, answer. Okay, for example, you can ask how many different kinds of solids are there, and people have done that classification more than a century back, and they figured out that in three dimensions, there are essentially 230 different ways in which you can break symmetry to make a crystal, and that's it. Okay, so you can get a classification of all the different types of crystals, and this also tells you a way to gives you a smoking gun way of establishing this phase. You simply measure the symmetry breaking, you measure this order parameter. Okay, and you can do that using X-ray scattering, so it also gives you a handle to identify one of these phases. Okay, and in combination, people have been able to figure out all the different ways of breaking symmetry, trying to tell if a particular material is in one of these phases. And remarkably, you can realize all of these different ways of breaking symmetry in nature. Okay, and part of that success is because you can tell if a given material is in one of these phases. Okay, and so this program has been very successful. The only thing that's a little disappointing is that the states we're talking about are rather simple from the quantum mechanical point of view. Okay, so for example, a crystal, you can essentially think of it as atoms sitting in certain locations. It's a product state, if you like, with very little entanglement, at least in some limit. Okay, you can understand the essential aspects of a crystal from a weak entanglement point of view. Okay, so what you'd like to do is to generalize this program to more general states of matter. Okay, states of matter maybe that we know of. Also, maybe this will give us a handle to think about phases that we didn't previously know of. Okay, so this was the program for the case of conventional phases. It hinged on having a way of distinguishing different states. Okay, and the analog, at least as far as we can tell right now, is we can look at states of matter that are the same as far as their symmetries are concerned. They have the same symmetries, but they could differ in terms of how they are entangled. Okay, and their pattern of entanglement could be different. And we're still trying to figure out all the different ways in which these patterns of entanglement can differ. We'll see already this has helped us to classify and also discover new states of matter. So some of the topological phases were actually found using this approach. And finally, you would like to have some way to experimentally go and measure this particular quantity. So again, this is something I doubt I would have been skeptical we would have been able to do by now. But there's actually a talk in this meeting, a very interesting talk, where the first steps in measuring entanglement in small systems has been taken, and it looks promising for to be scaled up. Okay, so maybe there's some hope in terms of porting over the successful program to more general states of matter. Okay, so before I get into the second part, let me make one more point, which you're probably unconsciously aware of, but it's good to emphasize. If you think about what makes quantum many-body physics hard, it's really the fact that there's a very big Hilbert space is very big. Okay, and you're looking for a vector in this very big Hilbert space, and really that has to do with entanglement. Okay, so the fact that we have this enormous complexity of Hilbert space is really a consequence of entanglement. So I won't really go about trying to define entanglement over here. I'm sure all of you are familiar, So we're talking about states like this versus states like that. Okay. Weakly entangled or unentangled states to things that are entangled. And if you had just these kind of product states, let's say you had n particles, you have this product state, you wanted to specify one of these states, that's very easy to specify. You simply specify the sequence of zeros and ones. You just need n bits to specify such a product state. Okay, but if you wanted to specify a general state in the Hilbert space, something that's more like this, with different potentially different coefficients, then of course you need one complex number for each of these strings. So that's where that's what really makes quantum many body physics hard. So it's, on the one hand, we'll use entanglement as a tool, but really that's behind all of the exponential growth of complexity that makes many body physics both rich and hard. Okay, so so let me just quickly go over the trying to box or trying to classify all the different ways in which we'll be looking at entanglement in many body systems. So it's useful to think of these three distinct buckets in terms of increasing entanglement in some sense. So we, on the one hand, we have gapped phases, and we believe that the entanglement over here can be bounded. It's believed to be an area law. It just depends on the perimeter of the region that you're looking at. On the other hand, you have thermal phases, where the entanglement is expected to grow with the volume of your system. Okay, so let me talk a little bit about these thermal phases and sort of highlight what are the interesting questions over here. Okay, so if you take a highly excited state of a quantum many-body system, it essentially looks like a thermal state, at least by and large, that's what you expect. And this is the eigenstate thermalization hypothesis. And there, actually, the role played by entropy, the quantity that plays the role of entropy, is really entanglement. Okay, the entanglement entropy turns out to be the same as the thermal entropy you would expect for a thermal state with the same energy density. Okay, so in some sense, these are highly entangled states, just in terms of the amount of entanglement. But in some ways, they are also very classical. They're just described by thermal physics. Okay, so the counterexample to that kind of behavior is a localized phase. Okay, that's at least one counterexample. And you can look at very highly excited states of a localized system. Typically, one is thinking about a system which has disorder that is strong enough to localize all of the excitations. and you end up with a state that has a finite energy density. A large amount of energy in your can be put into the system, but it still remains non-thermal. Again, there's very good evidence that such states exist. And a very interesting question over here is whether a system can move from this description to that one. Okay, so we said that this, although it has large entanglement, this is really a very classical system. Over here in the localized phase, you have quantum mechanical effects. So this transition is really one that goes from a classical to a quantum behavior in a many-body system. Okay, and there are going to be quite a few talks that are related to this. There'll be one talk that is an overview on localization, and also a couple of talks, one on this transition, both of them actually on this transition between the localized and thermal phases. Okay, and one of the very nice results that's come out in this area has been looking at this transition purely from an entanglement point of view. Okay, and this is something that Tarun Grover may mention, but you can use various general properties of the entanglement entropy, the strong subadditivity property, which has appeared in other situations as well, to make some general statements about what can and cannot happen at this transition. Okay, and maybe he'll mention that in his talk. Yeah, and finally, there's an interesting open question that's raised by the paper by these authors, which is when we think of a state which has volume law entanglement, the only examples we know of so far are really thermal states. Okay, so in some sense, as soon as you get volume law entanglement, you end up with a classical state. Could you get something that's different, that's fundamentally different from a thermal state, so it retains some quantum mechanical properties, but yet has an entanglement that scales with the volume of the system. Okay, so that's a very interesting question, but also very hard to answer in any rigorous way. Okay, so that was for these thermal states. The other area that's very active is talking about entanglement in gapless systems. Okay, in fact, this is probably where the notion of entanglement entropy entered into many-body physics. And it started really by looking at conformal field theories, starting with one plus one dimensional conformal field theories, where the central charge C controls the growth of this entanglement entropy. Okay, and since then, it's been generalized to different dimensions, and there are analogs of the C in higher dimension. And the interesting thing is that all of these analogs are, in some sense, most naturally defined in terms of entanglement. Okay, and for example, F is related to the entanglement of a disk in two dimensions. This is for the 2 plus 1 dimensional conformal field theories. We're going to hear a lot more about this. And in fact, Horacio is going to give an overview of that. Okay, and one of the things that comes out of this all of this work on conformal field theories, it appears to make to be able to answer some questions, some pressing questions we have in condensed matter about the stability of certain states. Okay, can certain states of matter that appear in theories of strongly correlated systems actually be stable, or are they prone to some instability that makes them into more conventional states? Okay, and in fact, again, this is something that one can use entanglement to try to address, put some constraints, and I guess that will be discussed in this particular talk. Okay, so that's one form of gapless matter, conformal field theories. Another setting where you get gapless excitations are states which have Fermi surfaces. Okay, and the simplest example, of course, are free fermion phases or weakly interacting systems where you get Fermi liquids, but there are also non-Fermi liquids. And despite their name, these non-Fermi liquids have Fermi surfaces. Okay, and one way to sort of identify them is to look at entanglement of those states and see if you can identify the excess entanglement that you would get because of these Fermi surfaces. Okay, so that's sort of a lightning review of entanglement in these two cases. And finally, let me just quickly mention something about gap states before I talk about the last talk in detail about one particular example. That will also be a gap state, but that will be a very simple non-interacting phase. So in the context of gap states, the subject that's gotten the most attention goes like this. Okay, so let's say I give you a Hamiltonian which has some parameters, but this Hamiltonian has no particular symmetry. Okay, so for example, these could be spins that live on some lattice, and there are various interactions that I've picked. But this is sort of because of these parameters, you can think of this as some generic Hamiltonian. Okay, so conventionally, you would say that this system will not have phases; everything has the same symmetry. Okay, but it turns out if you just numerically study this model, you find that there are phase transitions, and potentially that means that there could be two phases. Okay, and both of these phases are gapped. So in terms of the low energy excitation spectrum, they look kind of the same. Okay, they have some ground state and there's some energy gap. Okay, but turns out they are distinct phases. There are many different ways of understanding why this model has two different phases. One is to map it to a gauge theory in a certain limit where it's very obvious. But ultimately, probably the best way of telling the difference is to look at entanglement. Okay. So if you look at a gap phase, and we're going to make some assumptions that you find some way of partitioning the system so that there's a smooth boundary, and it has certain circumference. Because this is a gap phase, you expect the entropy to grow only slowly, only as the perimeter of this region. But what is shown by these people is that there's a subdominant piece, something that lowers your entanglement entropy, but just by a constant. Okay, that's independent of this length of the boundary. And this number is something characteristic of your state. Okay, so for a trivial state, this number is just zero, But for the particular state that we looked at, the non-trivial phase, this number is exactly log 2. And sort of an intuitive way of thinking about this distinction is that the non-trivial phase that we found is actually the deconfined phase of a gauge theory. Okay, so it admits excitations that are like charges, and these charges are obey a Gauss law. Okay, so if you just look at a boundary, by applying the Gauss law, you know in a ground state, there are no charges inside, so there's a constraint on this electric field at the boundary. Okay, so what you would have thought is that if I look at this boundary, there's a lot of uncertainty in the fluctuation of these electric fields. That's what gives you this entanglement entropy. You can think of entropy as the degree of your ignorance. So you have a lot of ignorance about what the electric field is, but you actually know a little bit more than you might think. Okay, so because of this Gauss law, you know that there are no charges inside. So there are this electric field has to satisfy a constraint that the sum of the electric field has to sum to zero. Okay, and because this is an Ising version of electromagnetism, that amount of information is exactly 1 bit. Okay, so that lowers the entanglement entropy, that lowers your ignorance by 1 bit. Okay, and that's really this the way in which you can identify this non-trivial phase. Okay, and in fact, this program was applied to a more realistic, a more interesting model, which was pointed out by Steve White and collaborators, that the Kigume antiferromagnet might be a quantum spin liquid in the same phase, and calculations of this particular quantity here at Santa Barbara seem to reveal a very accurate correspondence with this log 2. Okay, so there seems to be quite a lot of evidence that this very natural model of spins on the Kigume lattice is in this non-trivial topological phase. There are even some materials that are believed to be in the same phase. Okay, so that's a very nice correspondence from purely theoretical ideas to model systems which may have applications to real materials. Okay, so so that was as far as the overview goes, and maybe now I'll switch and sort of give you a more kind of specific example where we can use entanglement as a way to think about states of matter. Okay, but maybe before I do that, any questions or comments? Anything that I'm sure I've left out you know, a lot. If anyone wants to add comments, yeah. So actually, I should confess, I have not read the paper either. But just hearing about the work, it seems to me a way of thinking about gauge theories, but thinking about them in a different way where symmetry is emphasized. So if that is right, then these would be like the gauge theory that I mentioned, where there's a certain topological entanglement entropy. Right.
Which whose order parameter distinguished the two phases.
Yeah, yeah. But it's, of course, it's, you know, there's some twist there because it's not the usual story with symmetry.
Yeah, it's not a, it's a broader definition of symmetry.
Right, right.
Over different dimensional.
Yeah,
numbers.
Yeah. And my understanding is that gives you, that's a different way of thinking about a gauge theory. It may have been a U1 gauge theory, so it has gapless excitations, but essentially it's, the Z2 case, okay, yeah. Okay, anything else? Okay, so okay, so let me talk about the simplest problem that you could imagine, which is a problem that involves free fermions. Okay, and these free fermions move in a lattice, and because of this lattice, you could get an insulating state where you fill up all of the bands below a certain energy, and the bands above let's say your chemical potential is here, all the bands that are above this energy are empty. Okay, so this is the description of a band insulator. This was sort of a great triumph many years back of applying quantum mechanics to understand the properties of solids. Okay, if you could fill up a band, you get an insulator. If, on the other hand, there are electrons up here, you get a metal. Okay, now you may think that this insulator is essentially the same as taking electrons and putting them at certain positions inside the crystal. Okay, and you can just think of them as neutral atoms, for example. And this is one limit of an insulator. Okay, and we know that there are systems like this. They're very close to just being atoms weakly perturbed by all of their the surrounding particles. Okay, now it turns out that in the modern viewpoint, what we have discovered is that in fact this is not always true. Okay, there are insulators which you can think of simply as free electrons filling a band, but you can never reduce them to the simple picture of electrons sitting at certain sites in a crystal. Okay, and these insulators are called topological insulators. Often there are some symmetries thrown in. You should be careful about what symmetries you preserve or not don't preserve. and when you look at this picture, this is sort of supposed to be the wave function of these electrons. You can see that since you cannot localize all the electrons at a single site, otherwise you lose some essential property of this insulator. There is some sort of entanglement. If I make a cut in real space, I should always see a bit of the electronic wave function crossing that plane. And I shouldn't be able to drag apart this wave function so that it simply sits at the atomic cores. Okay, the picture was like this. If I make an entanglement cut, the entanglement would simply be zero. Okay, there should be some obstruction. So we should be able to rephrase this physics in terms of entanglement. That way of rephrasing may or may not pay some dividend. We'll see it does. But anyway, it's an interesting question how this appears in entanglement. Okay, so the simplest example of such a topological band insulator is called a Chern insulator. It exists in two dimensions, and it's essentially the integer quantum Hall effect, but in some system which has a lattice. Okay, and if you look at the filled bands and you were to calculate this quantity, some integral over these filled bands, you would find that it's an integer, and a non-zero integer means that you have this interesting physical situation. You have a gap in the bulk, but you have some edge states that move around in just one direction. How many edge states? That's given by this integer over here. Okay, so of course, to get this kind of interesting behavior, this sort of edge states, you can't make this happen by having electrons just sit on atomic sites. Okay, they've got to do something more than that. So the picture is like this, what I had before. The wave function is actually spread out through the crystal, and there's no way to collapse it onto the atomic sites. Okay, so imagine we make a cut, and we ask what is the signature in entanglement that diagnoses this Chern insulator. Okay, now it turns out that entanglement entropy doesn't give you any signature. Okay, so I think that emphasizes the fact that when you talk about entanglement, it's not just entanglement entropy. You really need to know where to look in order to bring out the non-trivial physics. Okay, but you can do something more than that. You can go and look at not just the entropy of your reduced density matrix, but the entire spectrum. Okay, so that's called the entanglement spectrum. It was introduced by Lee and Haldane. Okay, and the entanglement spectrum is, as usual, you trace out, let's say, the region B. You're left with the reduced density matrix for region A. And this is a density matrix, so it has non-negative eigenvalues. So you can always write it as the exponential of some Hermitian operator. Okay, and we'll call that the Hamiltonian, the entanglement Hamiltonian. Okay, of course, it has nothing to do with the original Hamiltonian per se. It's just a property of the ground state of your system. Okay, but I can look at the spectrum of this Hamiltonian. In fact, because this cut has got translation symmetry in this direction, I can label the states of this Hamiltonian by momentum along this direction. Okay, and also, this is a free fermion problem, so this Hamiltonian is just a quadratic operator of the fermions, so I can look at the matrix that's in this quadratic form. Okay, and if you look at the eigenvalues of this matrix, this is essentially the energy as a function of this momentum. You find a dispersion that looks like that. The derivative of this is the velocity. So this is really something analogous to the chiral edge states that you've had physically. Okay, so if you look at the physical spectrum, of a system which has a boundary, you'll find a chiral edge state. You'll find one of these one-way propagating edge states, and that's also reflected in this entanglement cut. Okay, so in fact, you can prove that whenever you have physical edge states in these free fermion systems, and even for interacting systems, if you have some topologically mandated edge states, you'll also see the edge states in your entanglement cut. Okay, so it's kind of interesting that the ground state wave function encodes the fact that the excitations will have this character, they'll have this chiral character. Okay, but you know, that in itself is fine, but it's just a different way of seeing the same physics. The question is, can you get anything new from entanglement? Okay, and the interesting thing is that this you know, this logical connection doesn't flow the other way. Okay, so sometimes you have, in certain systems, you can get entanglement edge states, something like this, although the physical edge does not have that property. Okay, in that case, you can use entanglement to diagnose a phase of matter, which would have been hard to diagnose if you had only access to the physical edge. Okay, so I'll give you an example of that. So this example involves inversion symmetry. Okay, so the key point is that if you have a state of matter that's protected by some symmetry, and that symmetry happens to be inversion, so inversion takes the outside to the inside if you have a cut, so an edge or a physical edge of the system always breaks inversion symmetry. Okay, so you have no choice, you always break inversion symmetry. So if there's some property of that state that's protected by inversion, you're not going to see it at a physical edge. Okay, now the nice thing about entanglement is that in some secret sense, it can preserve this inversion symmetry. Okay, so let me sort of rephrase this entanglement cut in terms of the Schmidt decomposition. I have some ground state wave function. I break it into right and left. I've switched from this A and B, right and left, and you sum over the different states with some weight. Okay, and so let me just think of a one-dimensional system, very simple, and you have some entanglement spectrum. Okay, these weights I just plot. Okay, so now if you perform inversion, the right is mapped to the left and vice versa. So on the face of it, it seems like inversion is not a symmetry of your reduced density matrix. Okay, but it turns out there's a way to get back, and the way to get back is using the Schmidt decomposition. Okay, Schmidt decomposition gives you some association between right and left states. So you go from right to left by inversion, but then you can come back using the Schmidt states. Okay, and in this way, you can make inversion a physical symmetry, you know, you can ask how this entanglement spectrum transforms under inversion. Okay, the key thing is that when you do this operation, inversion becomes an anti-unitary symmetry. Okay, so usually symmetries are implemented by unitary operators, with the one exception of time reversal symmetry. It turns out over here, inversion, when you restrict its application to the reduced density matrix, or just to one side, becomes an anti-unitary symmetry. Okay, so then you can ask whether inversion squares to plus or minus 1. That's a meaningful question for an anti-unitary symmetry. When it squares to plus 1, it's just this, a normal entanglement spectrum. When it squares to minus 1, it has this Kramers-like degeneracy. Okay, and this distinguishes two different phases that are protected by inversion symmetry. Okay, so I'm missing a reference. This is due to Ari Turner and various collaborators. Okay, so so this was one of the cases where we can get a deeper understanding of some topological phases using entanglement, which you cannot do with just looking at the edge states. Okay, so actually, I overheard the question in the front row. Do you want me to answer that? So David's question was, how are these phases different? So it turns out that so these are phases that are you know, they're gap phases, and they belong to the same class of topological phases which typically have edge states. But in this particular case, because it is inversion that is protecting them, you don't see the edge state. Okay, but there are other quantities you can look at. If I if I think of these as being some charges on a line, you can calculate the polarization of these charges. And it turns out that with inversion symmetry, polarization can either be 0 or pi. So if you like, polarization is just the displacement of the charges from the centers. this quantity is only defined modulo the lattice spacing. So if you ask under inversion symmetry, polarization changes sign, but a quantity that's so normally you would say that's 0, but for a quantity that's only defined modulo 2 pi, it can also be pi. So this corresponds to polarization pi, and this is polarization 0. Okay, so let me now turn to this new question that we had, which is also benefits from thinking about in terms of entanglement. Okay, if I started motivating this whole discussion by asking when an insulator can be considered an atomic insulator, okay, and when there are obstructions to thinking like that. So we'll talk about an example where we already talked about a topological phase where there's such an obstruction, but now I'll give you an example where this sort of atomic picture is forbidden just from the band filling. Okay, so there are examples which we found recently where if I just tell you the band filling, you can construct some insulator that looks like this in momentum space, but there are too few sites on this side to accommodate an atomic insulator. Okay, and in that case, again, it's useful to think about entanglement for to define that phase. Again, this is work done mainly by my student Adrian Poe at Berkeley. Okay, so in order to explain this to you, unfortunately, I have to tell you a little bit about Kittel solid-state physics. Okay, so many of you may have bad memories of reading about crystal lattices, all the 230 of them, but I'm going to be interested in one key distinction between crystal lattices. So these are, they have symmetries which involve translations and some things like rotations, reflections, and so on. The simplest case is when these symmetries simply form a direct product. Okay, there's a point group, things like rotations and reflections that leave some point fixed, and there are translations. Okay, and they cleanly separate into a product. Okay, these are called symorphic lattices. So this cubic lattice is an example of a symorphic lattice. And if you ask where can atoms sit in this lattice, for example, the atom can sit in the center, and then it's invariant under all of these point group symmetries, and it's just translation, so in every unit cell you will have just a single atom. Okay, so you can represent these symorphic lattices with just one atom in the center of your unit cell. Okay, now it turns out that most crystals are not like this. Okay, most of the crystals in nature and most of these most of the 230 are actually non-symorphic, okay, where the symmetries don't break up in the simple way. For example, they may have elements like glides. So you do a reflection and then you translate along the mirror plane, but the translation is just half the lattice vector. Okay, so in this case, it turns out you need at least two atoms in the unit cell to represent this symmetry. Okay, so I asked Adrian to come up with a picture of a non-symorphic lattice, and instead of atoms, he somehow came up with this. so people, this is to show you reflections. So this lattice, if you reflect along this plane and translate by a half unit, you get to this, get from here to there. Okay, so it has this sort of glide, and if you look at any crystal made up, of atoms, you will have at least two atoms in the unit cell, a right-handed and a left-handed person in this depiction, one with the right and left hand raised. Okay, so there's no escaping that. So in the simple case, you need at least two atoms in the unit cell. So these are called Wyckoff positions. And for every single crystal group, you can come up with there's a tabulated list of where these atoms can sit. Okay, so the one that turns out to be interesting, you don't really need to know the details. It's something that's non-symorphic, and it's something that is cubic. Okay, these two turn out to be the key ingredients. And if you look at the crystal where atoms can sit, it turns out you need at least four sites in order to define this crystal. Okay, so I've shown you two unit cells, but there are at least four sites. Okay, so now if you wanted to make an atomic insulator, you'd have to put two electrons on each of these sites, spin up and spin down. So you'd think that the minimum filling to get a band insulator is eight. Okay, eight electrons per unit cell. Okay, now it turns out if you go and write down a simple band structure and play around with these band structure parameters, you can come up with some Hamiltonian that has just four bands. Okay, these are non-degenerate bands. So if I just fill up these four bands, put the chemical potential over here, I get a band insulator that has only four electrons. Okay, so if you think about it, how can these four electrons sit inside this unit cell? If you force the electrons to sit on one of these symmetry allowed sites, then there's a problem because you need to specify which direction their spin is pointing, and that would break time reversal symmetry. Okay, so any classical picture of this insulator would break some symmetry. But you know, this quantum mechanically, you can put them into these waves, these wave states, and they can form an insulating phase, which is sort of delocalized in this unit cell. Okay, and there's no way to kind of further pinpoint them without actually breaking some symmetry. Okay, so when you have a state like this, it implies there is some unremovable entanglement, and you should be able to exhibit that entanglement to really understand the state. So in fact, we could do that, or Adrian could do that. So you can start with these levels filled, and you want an entanglement cut that preserves all the symmetries. Okay, and that's really the key thing. And again, this is an example where you have to pick exactly what kind of entanglement to look at to suit the problem. Okay, so if you were to make the usual cut that divides left and right, you would end up breaking the cubic symmetry. Okay, and none of these features are going to be apparent. It should still be true that there's some unremovable entanglement, but you'll have a hard time proving that. Okay, so but instead, what you can do is each of these sites can have spins pointing in opposite directions, so you can do the entanglement cut in spin space. Okay, so spin up is like your left system, and spin down is your right system. Okay, and that's what we did. And when you look at the entanglement spectrum, it turns out that there are always states that cross this energy half. This is like the middle of this entanglement. These are states that are exactly half on the left and half on the right. And it turns out that you can never get rid of this gaplessness in the entanglement spectrum. The time reversal symmetry that exchanges these two turns out to be a particle hole symmetry that forces some states to lie at this energy. Okay, so that tells you there's no way to go from this particular band insulator to an atomic limit just by looking at the entanglement. Okay, so I think I've more or less run out of time. I have 2 minutes, okay. okay, so in conclusion, I've tried to sort of give you an overview, but I think the main message is that we now have a new way of thinking about many-body systems that's proved to be surprisingly versatile, can work, work on different problems, and it's already given us some new insights. Okay, there are many questions that we don't really understand very well. For example, what does it mean for a state to have a lot of entanglement, and what does it mean for a state to really be very quantum? Okay, so some gross measures of entanglement are obviously not useful. For example, thermal states have a lot of entanglement. Okay, but we think of them as classical states. Just the degree of entanglement is not a measure of how quantum the state is. And it's really a question maybe of whether this entanglement is short or long-ranged. So we know some cases where, for example, the constant in these topological phases, that's a manifestation of long-range entanglement. Nothing with short-range entanglement can give you that. Okay, but there are many other such criteria, I'm sure, that are waiting to be discovered. Also, what kinds of entanglement can you get starting from a local Hamiltonian? Okay, for example, the proposal that Matthew and Tarun came up with, something with volume law entanglement that's less than the thermal value, but is a stable phase. Could that happen? So many questions like this that are still open, and entanglement gives you a way to phrase these questions, okay, although we may not know how to answer them yet. Okay, so let me stop here.
Questions? Is the thermal entropy of a state, is it necessarily an upper bound for a possible entanglement entropy?
Yeah, for that particular energy density, yeah. That's how you define the thermal entropy, it's like a maximum.
Okay.
Time.
This is more maybe baiting than a question, but I want to hear more about the last thing. Like, can you, what are the possibilities that are out there, or the specific questions, the burning questions about that?
You mean
the different patterns of entanglement? Yeah.
Yeah, so one example I gave you, can you get volume law entanglement, but that is not the thermal value, right? So something that's subthermal, but still a stable phase. So there are proposals like that. You can write down wave functions that have that character. The question is, can they be eigenstates of a local Hamiltonian? And other questions that you can ask, for example, suppose I give you a translationally invariant system. Can you have highly excited states that do not obey the eigenstate thermalization hypothesis? So have low entanglement despite being the excited states of a clean system. And you know, could they be all the way to MBL, which is, you know, really some area law, let's say. So those have to do with thermal versus not thermal. Actually, if you look at rigorous proofs, we don't even have a proof of the area law for gap phases. You know, there are some, you know, you can cook up some strange Hamiltonians that have a lot of degeneracy and so on, which look like ground states, which may have volume law entanglement. So I think in terms of rigorous results, we, you know, there's still a lot, there's a lot out there that needs to be understood.
So is all of that sort of basically two-party entanglement? What about different patterns of multi-party entanglement?
Yeah, that's a good question.
What is the state of the art there?
Yeah, so you know, all the studies I know have been of this two-party entanglement, and as you know, it has many nice properties, right? For example, the entanglement entropy of region A, you know, for a ground state, for example, the same as entanglement entropy of, if you look at B, and a lot of these properties are lost when you don't have the Schmidt decomposition of the same way for tripartite or something. Yeah, so other measures of entanglement, I think that's sort of comes back to the first question. You know, just using entanglement entropies may not be the best way to characterize the degree of entanglement. Maybe you need other ways.
Yeah, just to ask a clarification on the volume law, could you get something that scales with the volume, but the coefficient is actually higher?
No. So that is also, so if that happened, all your states would like to go and become that state, right?
I mean, you might expect, I mean, say from holographic systems, you might expect to get something where you have a horizon being gripped by something that you impose on the boundary, you know, boundary condition, and then your surfaces would also follow the horizon, so they would have larger somehow.
But I think it's sort of like a tautology. You define the thermal state as the maximum entropy state with a certain energy.
Okay.
Right. Yeah. And that's how you do thermodynamics. And yeah.
More questions? Since no one's asking a question, I might ask you.
So that's one option, yeah.
So does entanglement cut the inversion becoming anti-unitary? How does that come about?
Okay, so so one way to phrase that is the following. You know, what happens when I want to bring this state so I have a state on the left, I do inversion, it becomes a state on the right, and I want to bring it back to the left. OK, Okay, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to use this association over here. And I'm, you know, so I can sort of set all of these coefficients to one. And this gives me some natural way to associate states on the left and right. Okay, and the way I could do it operationally is to take, you know, the complex conjugate of the state and take the inner product with the state. Right, so if it's the right state, it'll, you know, combine with this and just give me a state on the left. But in that process, I've taken a complex conjugation, so it becomes an anti-unitary operator. And the same reason, the final example that I showed, you have time reversal, so it becomes a unitary operator.
Related question on that, in the final example you showed, if you look at the cubic symmetry group, then instead of taking the spin cut, and if I take a real cut, then there is secretly some cubic symmetry left that translates into something weird in the entanglement Hamiltonian.
There probably is, but it's very hard to have any intuition for what that is. So it probably relates the entanglement spectrum of different cuts.
Okay.
You have very few quantum numbers to track things, and you know you're kind of shooting in the dark. This cut is really good because you preserve all the quantum numbers, and it's very easy to show it's always gapless.
Yeah, nice. In the end, you mentioned other meshes of entanglement. So, can you give some examples? So, what kind of meshes do you have in mind?
So, I was actually thinking about it's still we're still thinking of bipartite entanglement, but not necessarily the entanglement entropy, right? Okay, so you know the truly radical thing is to just go away from this bipartite entanglement, which is what is proposed. That you think of tripartite entanglement, you think of decomposing your state into three subregions. You know, vector spaces have three subregions, and you know, people know a little bit about such tripartite entanglement, but there's much less, you know, there's less useful properties to work with compared to just the bipartite one. But even within the bipartite entanglement, you have a lot of choice about what you take your cut as. Does it have to be a real space cut? You can look at the entire spectrum, not just at the entropy of these of the different states, and you can look at the not just the eigenvalues but also the states themselves. So there's a lot of information just in that bipartite entanglement cut. So you know it's sort of better to exhibit it maybe like you know. Did I do it here? No, I think it's. Just as a Schmidt decomposition. So it's not just the trace over these numbers, it's the numbers themselves and these states as well. And that's been very useful, at least from the context of these topological phases.
You didn't mention it, but you would have maybe some insight into it. So there's been a bunch of recent work showing that different chiral phases have the same edge spectrum, the same top. So you know, going against this whole topological entanglement entropy, and entanglement Hamiltonian classifies everything. Just where do you think, how do you think it will resolve, or where does it fit in?
Yeah. So I think that's somewhat similar to the fact that even different edge states can be in different phases. So the question is that you know, especially if you look at higher dimensional systems. So in one dimension, not too much happens, but if you have a two-dimensional system with the one-dimensional edge. The entanglement Hamiltonian, you can roughly think of it as the effective Hamiltonian for this one-dimensional system. And that can be in different phases. Okay, so it can have the complexity of a one-dimensional system. And you have to be a little careful about that when you diagnose a phase, that you should allow for the fact that it could be in different phases and you know, it's a Hamiltonian with different phases. And that's true also of the physical edge. So in that sense, there's a mapping between the physical edge states of a real system and the entanglement edge states. The physical edge can also be in different phases, and then you'd work a little harder. For example, in these symmetry-protected topological phases, the edge breaks the symmetry. Then you'd work a little harder in order to find a smoking gun signature of the phase. So that's something that's worthwhile to keep in mind. that this helps you, but there are some cases where, you know, it may not give you the final answer.
Actually, it's a more general problem. You can have the same exact state be a ground state of Hamiltonians in completely different phases.
Say it again.
You can have the same problem just at the level of the state. Like, forget about entanglement spectra or whatever. You can have the exact same ground state as a ground state of two different, completely different phases.
The same ground state but different phases?
Yes.
So you mean the excitation spectrum is different? Or what's different then?
The Hamiltonian.
Yeah, or the same, two different Hamiltonians can give you them states.
You can have the same ground state.
Yeah, sure. But if you want to classify which phase the Hamiltonian is, it's not like you want to come back to the Hamiltonian, you just want to know which phase the ground state is in. Then there's no problem, right?
No, it's the same state, it's the same ground state. So you can't distinguish what phase it's in. Hamiltonian can be in two different phases with the exact same ground state.
But yeah, the phase is the property of the state, right?
Not of the ground state.
Okay, I won't be able to.
State, you can have a gap phase and a gapless phase.
Yeah, okay, that, right? And they have the same ground state.
Exact same ground state.
Yes, I know models like that, yeah. So that goes back to the question of whether the ground state has all the information of a phase or not.
Right.
And all the examples and the counterexamples I know are all kind of weird. Yeah, but for a generic Hamiltonian without certain, if I put in a few, you know, caveats, which we know can, you know, create problems, then the ground state usually is an accurate reflection of this Hamiltonian, or the phase in which the system is in. And for Lorentz invariant systems, you can make that, you know, that's you can make that into a theorem.
Discussion of what a phase is. Maybe we can stop this talk. There's a break now and we'll pursue at 3:30.